This is a special recording of the Isaiah lesson number 61. Unfortunately, the recording that I made in class didn't work, so I'm recording it outside of class for my wife, who didn't get to hear the lesson, so now she'll get to hear her own private lesson. So here we go. This is lesson number 61 in a series of lessons on highlights from the book of Isaiah. And as I do every once in a while, I'm going to give us a quick look at the outline, make sure we all know where we are on the map as far as it goes with the material that we're covering. As you recall, we are on the last section of the last section. This is the section that talks about the servants, that would be you and I, the people of God, inheriting God's kingdom. And you may recall, it's been a while since I covered it, but that particular section has what I describe as a chiastic structure, and I'm not going to go into all that again this morning, but if you were here last time, you'll remember a chiastic structure is a structure that has a series of steps there. It goes in, it gets to a middle point, and it comes back out following those same steps. And it's basically a poetic way of highlighting a part of a piece of information. So when you're teaching or when you're writing, if you want to give emphasis to something, there's a lot of different ways you can do that. One way is you can make it the first thing you say and say, hey, this is the big deal, and then you can go on from there. Another way to do it is to make it the last thing you cover, so it's kind of like the crescendo. But another way of giving emphasis, a poetic way, is to put it in a chiastic structure where everything moves toward that, and then everything moves back away from that. And that's what we have for this section we've been in for the last couple of weeks. Jerusalem is the light of the world. That's sort of the what I've called the crown jewel of the book of Revelation and of this particular last section of Isaiah, in the last section. This week, we're starting to come back out of the chiasm, and we're going to be looking at the divine warrior, chapter 63, verses 1 through 6. So that's kind of where we are on the map. Just wanted to give everybody an overview of that so we can keep up with where we are. So in chapter 63, Isaiah moves from talking about the future, when the light will have dawned on a redeemed Israel, and through them on the whole world, to a sobering description of what must take place if that light is to dawn. So we've been looking the last few weeks, it's been a very bright picture. Literally, we've talked about light, we've talked about the nations coming to see the light, coming to Israel, and all been very positive. But in order for that to take place, there is a rather sobering, might even say a dark thing that has to take place in order to do all that needs to happen for that to happen. And we'll be explaining as we go through, and that's what we're doing this week. So a very different flavor to the things that we're looking at this week. Because in Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6, our text this morning, we will be looking at the divine warrior, the one who God will use to defeat every enemy of his people, including the most dangerous enemy, as we've said all along, which is sin. We've already had one section dealing with the divine warrior. This one deals with many of the same ideas, but it's much more intense, and it's much more sobering, as you will see. And because of the physical and military imagery used in these verses, you might think, if you're just looking on the surface, that what is intended here is an announcement that God will defeat all the nations who oppose or oppress Israel in the future. Of course, that's certainly true, but it goes beyond that. And that's the thing you've always got to remember about Isaiah. We've seen that over and over. There's what's happening at one level, and it's true. But then there's always the deeper level, and sometimes the deeper level of a deeper level. And that's what we're looking at with this. And it becomes very obvious. So this is made clear by what's said in the remainder of the book. And it's also even clear within the section itself, as we're going to see. In previous sections of the book, we saw how the Lord's servant dealt with sin that exists within the hearts and lives of his own people by his own shed blood at a substitutionary sacrifice. And that would be, there have been several passages that brought this out, but probably the clearest passage is Isaiah 53. So our big problem is sin, especially within the hearts of the people of God. And the servant, who we know is Jesus, dealt with that sin by shedding his own blood and acting as a substitutionary sacrifice. That had to happen, and we've seen that, and that's a part of how we get the beautiful picture that we saw last week. But there's more, and that's what we're going to look at this week. Today, Isaiah describes in vivid poetic language how God will destroy the enemies of him and his people. Thus, the blood that stains, blood stains that we see on the garments of the victor described in today's text is the blood of sinners from all nations, including those within his own nation who have defied him. So now we have blood, but it's not Christ's blood shed for us. This is the blood of his enemies that is shed as he destroys those enemies. The defiant character of God's enemies is symbolized in this text by the nation of Edom, similar to the way Edom was used in an earlier passage in the book, and it's actually a section we didn't look at earlier, so I bring it to your attention now, but Edom is frequently used in this way. The earlier passage says in Isaiah 34, verses 5 through 8, the Lord says, "Indeed, my sword has slaughtered heavenly powers. Look, it now descends on Edom, on the people I will annihilate in judgment. The Lord's sword is dripping with blood, for the Lord is holding a sacrifice in Bozrah," that's the capital of Edom, "a bloody slaughter in the land of Edom. Their land is drenched with blood, for the Lord has planned a day of revenge, a time," and here's the key phrase, "he will repay Edom for her hostility towards Zion." Edom here represents those who are hostile towards Zion. Zion is the heart of God's dwelling place, God's people, the place where God manifests his glory, where the nations will come, all those things. And there are those who are hostile to Zion. Edom is named as chief among those and therefore becomes sort of the symbol of what the Lord is going to do to all the enemies of God. And we're going to see that in our section again today. So this is a sort of a preview of what we are going to see today concerning Edom. In our text today, we will see that the responsibility to destroy God's enemies falls to the divine warrior and him alone. And he makes this clear several times in our text, verses 3 and 5. He says things like, "I did it all by myself. I looked, but there was no one to help." We'll see all this as we get to it. And the reason he has to do it alone is because he alone is the one who does not have to die for his own sins. Christ alone is the only one who qualifies in this way. He alone is the righteous judge who is without sin. He's the one to whom God has handed over all judgment. So the divine warrior here is actually Jesus. The purpose for this destruction is to make redemption and salvation available for his people. So there's a positive outcome, but it involves a very negative consequence for those who are being judged. Because until sin and those who propagate it are utterly defeated, the ultimate salvation that God has planned for his people cannot come about. Sin and all of its effects cannot and will not exist in God's eternal kingdom. So this is a necessary thing that has to take place in order for God's kingdom to be the place that it is. God's kingdom, we know, is a place that was without sin. It's without the effects of sin. There's no more pain, no more suffering, no more sorrow, no more death. And for that to happen, the enemies of God and sin itself has to be obliterated. The sin within the heart of his people has already been taken care of in Isaiah 53, but now the rest of sin is going to be dealt with by how we look at this, what happens in this passage today. So let's go ahead and read our text. Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6. I've entitled it "The Wrath of the Divine Warrior." Some have wanted to give it a title, "The Victory of the Divine Warrior Over His Enemies." That would be a fair title, but however we title it, here's what it says. "Who is this who comes from Edom, dressed in bright red, coming from Bozrah? Who is this one wearing royal attire, who marches confidently because of his great strength. It is I, the one who speaks in righteousness and who's able to deliver. Why are your clothes red? Why do you look like someone who stomped on grapes in a vat? I have stomped on grapes in the wine press all by myself. No one from the nations joined me. I stomped on them in my anger. I trampled them down in my rage. Their juice splashed on my garments and stained all my clothes. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. I looked, but there was no one to help. I was shocked because there was no one offering support. So my right arm accomplished deliverance. My raging anger drove me on. I trampled nations in my anger. I made them drunk in my rage. I splashed their blood on the ground. So you can see some very vivid and gory and startling imagery is being used here to describe these events. So we go back to the beginning and work our way through now. And you'll remember last week, I think it was, we covered the idea that the Lord had placed watchmen, and there was sort of an imagery there of, you know, the wall around the city, and there are watchmen on the wall, walls who are looking for potential threats to appear on the horizon. And in that case, they symbolize people who were praying. But here, I think it picks up on the idea again, even though the word watchman is not used, because there seems to be a description of a watchman here who sees a figure, perhaps riding on a horse, but striding up from the direction of Edom. Edom is south of Israel, and it's coming specifically from Bozrah, which is the capital of Edom. And again, as we've already made the point in our introduction, Edom was the longtime enemy of Judah, so much so that it often serves, as it does here, as a symbol of Israel's enemies. And I gave you one passage. We looked at Isaiah 34. There's others where this happens, not just in Isaiah. Well, this figure, this one who comes striding up, again, I envision on a horse, and there's a reason for that I'll get to later. This figure is obviously someone to be reckoned with. He's splendidly garbed in bright colored garments. He marches confidently with great strength as though he's just won some great victory. It's like a warrior coming back from battle, and he's pumped up, and we're going to see his clothes are actually splattered with the blood of his enemies. Such a person must clearly be challenged. If you're a watchman on the wall and somebody comes riding up to the city, you want to know who this is. Is this someone we should be put on alert for or what? So he asks, who is this who comes from Edom? The answer leaves no doubt as to who this figure is. It is I, the one who speaks in righteousness and who is able to deliver. This is the Lord himself who's speaking. And the characteristic by which he chooses to identify himself, first off, he identifies himself as the one who speaks. And from Genesis 1:3 to Revelation 21:5, one of the main characteristics of the God of the Bible is that he speaks. You know, Genesis 1:3, let there be light. He spoke, and light was. Revelation 21, it was written in the words of the book that he spoke and so forth. All the way through, God is the God of the Bible reveals his character, his ways, and his will to his creatures. He speaks. Indeed, it says he's the one who speaks in righteousness. That is, he speaks with authority that righteousness may be upheld and prevail throughout the world. A part of his assignment is to see to it that they who have been wrong are set to right. That's the job of the warrior, of Jesus. And in this respect, he's able to deliver. He's able to set things right. There's a timetable. It doesn't happen right away. But ultimately, he is able to do this very thing. And perhaps another way of describing this particular function of the divine warrior is to say that he directs the affairs of history. Ultimately, he's sovereign, and ultimately, he brings about the ends which he desires, which is to set things right. And he's able to deliver that. So verse 2, why are your clothes red? Why do you look like someone who stomped on grapes in a vat? So here we have a second exchange. You know, who are you? I'm the one who speaks in righteousness and so forth. And now he asks, why are your clothes red? So in the second exchange between the two characters, the warrior has gotten close enough for the sentry to see that his garments had not been made of red cloth, which maybe from a distance, it could look like just a red coat, but that they were that color because they have been reddened by something that's been splashed onto them. And reddened here, interestingly enough, is the Hebrew word adom, which is Edom, which means red, which you may know that if you know love Hebrew to know what Edom means. And he'd been to Edom where he got this red splattered on him. So there's a play on words here. There's several levels of poetry going on with the wording. Since he was approaching from Edom, which was well known for its wine production, the watchman compares the state of the warrior's clothes to those of someone who has stomped on grapes in a vat, or a what they would call a wine press. Apparently, Edom was well known in that time for growing grapes and taking those grapes and crushing them and producing wine. And so the first thing you think of, you just came from Edom, you look like you've got red grape juice spattered all over you. So in that day, a wine press typically consisted of two cavities carved in a rock. In the upper trough or cavity, grapes were trodden on to extract their juice. They would step on them and squish them, and then the juice flowed into a lower receptacle or cavity. And sometimes stomping on the newly harvested grapes or being too close to the process even could easily lead to one's clothing becoming stained. You can see how that could happen. So the watchman asked the approaching figure why he looked like someone who's been stomping around on grapes in a vat. He just had red splattered all over him. So just a little bit about what I just described to you so you can kind of try to picture this. This is a picture here of, this would be the treading pit. So they would take these freshly picked grapes. Usually this was placed in the middle of a vineyard, this kind of of arrangement. And they would place the grapes in here, and an individual or a series of individuals would stomp around. In this case, he has a stick to kind of help him keep his balance. It'd be easy to slip and fall. And as he's stepping on the grapes, the juice squishes out, and then it goes to a little drain hole down here. And a lot of times they would stuff it with brush or thistles to help filter out pulp and foreign objects, so they would just be like a pure juice that would end up in this collection vat, the lower rock. And then they would come along with a vessel like this, put the juice in the vessel, seal it with a cap, and then as it fermented, it would cause the final sealing of the cap, and you'd have wine. So this is how they made wine in the ancient world. And here is a picture of kind of more like a picture of how it looked when it was happening. So here you've got the upper vat, and you got all these guys in here stomping around. This guy looks like he maybe eaten a few of the grapes while he's stomping around in them. Then, of course, there would be a little hole that flows down to the lower part. And notice this guy over here in the back is carrying one of those vessels where he's picked up the juice and he's going to set it off to cure and form into wine. And notice where it is. It's in the middle of a vineyard. They're over here picking grapes. And here's a lady that's got grapes. She's carrying it over. So you kind of get an idea of the whole process here with this. It's kind of a nice picture here that was provided. So verse 3, I've stomped grapes in the wine press all by myself. No one from the nations joined me. I stomped on them in my anger. I trampled them down in my rage. Their juice splashed on my garments and stained all my clothes. So the warrior confirms that treading the wine trough is exactly what he's been doing. Although he does not explain the imagery here, he does in verse 6, it becomes quite clear. No explanation is needed. It becomes clear there's just a little bit more than just grapes involved here. But the grapes are an image, a gory image. He has attacked the enemies of his people in Edom, trodden them underfoot like grapes so that their lifeblood has spurted out and splattered his garment. That is a gross, gory picture, but that is the picture we have right here in our text this morning. Why has he done this? What was his motive? Well, he tells us, because of his anger and because of his rage. God is not the cruel judge impartially handing down verdicts on persons for whom he has no particular personal interest. God is portrayed here as a father whose children have been abused and mutilated. He's a king whose subjects have revolted and tried to usurp the throne. He's the creator whose creations have perverted themselves into the very opposite of the things for which they were created. He's angry, and rightly so. He has rage, and rightly so. You may have heard, if you studied philosophy, there was a Greek philosopher named Aristotle who came up with this sort of theological proof for the existence of God and described God as the unmoved mover. Well, I mean, to his point, it's fine, but the unmoved mover is the farthest thing from the God of the Bible, whose love is more enduring than the mountains and whose fury is more white hot than molten steel. That's a very poetic description. Compliments to my commentary there who came up with that. Here, as the prophet has said again and again, God's rage is directed against those who would destroy and oppress his people. He is furious against all that would deprive them of the blessing he wishes to give them. The imagery is gruesome in its vividness, and it says to us that we should do everything in our power to become part of his people and not be among the enemies. A chief idea in this verse is that there was no one to help. No one here to help the warrior in this awful task of splattering the blood of the enemies. Well, we think about that. No one helped. Who destroyed Edom? Was it Assyria? Babylonia? Persia? Another nation? No, Isaiah says none of these peoples has accomplished God's great historical purposes for him. And I think what we may see about this, they may have been tools that God used, but God alone accomplished the task, ultimately. And it's similar to what God says about his rescue of the people from Assyria. This is all the way back in chapter 10. You remember how he rescued Judea from Assyria? And he says this, "But can the axe boast greater power than the person who uses it? Is the saw greater than the person who saws? Can a rod strike unless a hand moves it? Can a wooden cane walk by itself?" Obvious rhetorical questions, answers to which, no. "Therefore, the Lord of heaven's armies, will send a plague among the Assyrians' proud troops, and a flaming fire will consume its glory." So God may use instruments, he may use tools, he may have used Assyria and various other nations to punish Edom along the way, but ultimately it's God and God alone who really is in control of history and who really brings about the ultimate ends that are pictured here. And of course, the hope of the world lies solely in the hand of the one who speaks in righteousness. It's being described here, this warrior. Until he defeats our enemies, both within and without, there is no hope for us. We would be forever condemned to a world like the one we live in now that's got this mix of sin where people are being delivered, but already, but not yet. But when he does, when the hope of the world is born anew. The importance of this thought for this section is seen in its being repeated here and in the parallel passage. We've already seen a passage that described this, but it just wasn't in near as gory and striking a language as this text. It's almost like the second go-round, we're really getting a hard hit now. It was introduced back in 59, 15b through 21. I won't reread it, but we looked at that section. So how is it possible for the New Jerusalem of chapter 60 to 62, that glorious Jerusalem we've been looking at for the last few weeks, how is it possible for that to exist? Only because the lone warrior made it possible. And this is part of how he makes it possible. This is a necessary move on his part. Verse 4 says, "For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. Isaiah gives the reason why God has acted, namely, the day of vengeance, that is the time for taking vengeance, was in his heart, that is, in his plans and purposes, and the year of his redeem has come, he says. And just as there was, you may remember back in chapter 61, there was a talk about a year when the Lord will show his favor, so also there is a year of his redeemed. I think there's actually some overlap in those two ideas. And now that this year has arrived, the Lord will take vengeance upon the nation. So basically, day and year here simply are ways of describing time in a sort of poetic way. And the point being made here is that God has a timetable. He doesn't jump immediately. There's an extended period where sin is allowed somewhat free rein, not outside God's sovereignty. But there's a day that God has set, and all that's going to end. And that's the scene that we're seeing today, where all that is brought to a complete and final finish, which God has intended from the very beginning. I looked, but there was no one to help. I was shocked because there was no one offering support. So my right arm accomplished deliverance. My raging anger drove me on. So this verse compares the Lord to a man who's confronted by a tremendous task. We've all been in this situation before. You come upon a situation and suddenly you're faced with a huge undertaking that you didn't expect. And you're going, oh my goodness, I got to do this. So the term that the commentary that I've used here is kind of a technical theological term. This is anthropomorphic passage. This is a passage where God is described in human terms in a way that we'd be able to relate to what is being experienced. So it's not that God literally was shocked, that God needed help. He didn't. But, yeah, it's just to make the point that he alone is the one who does this. In the situation where you come across this tremendous task, this sort of anthropomorphic, we'll just play this out here, one almost instinctively looks for others to help him, like, my goodness, this is so huge. I've got to get somebody to help me out here. And it would seem that his is so clear-cut a case of being in the right that there will be many who would flock to his side to help just to support such a great cause. I mean, obviously this needs to be done. Why aren't more people signing up for this? But there's no volunteers. The Lord must fall back on his own resources exclusively. And, as we know, and as we see here, these resources are more than adequate. His arm, that's a poetic way of describing his power, accomplished deliverance, salvation. And his raging anger drove him on. So there's the motivation is brought up again. Then we're told in verse 6, our final verse, I trampled nations in my anger. I made them drunk in my rage. I splashed their blood on the ground. This is the final dose of gore that we're given here, probably the toughest of all of it. Because here we see the nations thrown into a wine press and trampled. See, it's no longer saying Edom. Notice that? That's why I say Edom is representative of something much bigger. And here the larger point comes out. Isaiah always clues you in later. So when I start talking about levels, you're not left to your own devices or imagination. It's in the text. You just have to be careful to watch for it. So there it is. Nations made drunk with the wine of God's wrath. There's a lot of different ways of looking at that, but basically they've just, when a person's drunk, they've lost all control. They're stumbling on the ground. They're helpless. They're overwhelmed. Some have suggested, based on the next verse, this is the goriest of all, blood running to the ground in streams from the veins of guilty nations. Some have suggested, you know, drunk and choking on their own blood, perhaps. Whatever specifically is being pictured here, it's not a pretty picture. And I must point out that we see similar passages and none other than the book of Revelation, a book that I hope by the grace of God to get to and that this is preparation for. We're going to see that this text this morning is great preparation for a couple passages in Revelation, particularly Revelation 14, where it says, So the angel swung his sickle over the earth and gathered the grapes from the vineyard of the earth and tossed them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. There's the winepress language. Then the winepress was stomped. There's that. Outside the city. And blood poured out of the winepress. There's the blood idea from the winepress. Up to the height of horses' bridles for a distance of almost 200 miles. Well, there, the description is even stronger than just their blood hit the ground. It gives a quantity of blood that's unimaginable. So, what do we get from this? The judgment of God is grim business. Be not deceived. God is not mocked, Paul says. My goodness, no. This is shocking. And so that ends the description of the Lord's judgment on Edom, the enemies of God. But as noted earlier, the words are not limited to Edom. All who display the spirit of Edom will suffer the judgment that this passage describes as falling upon Edom. And that's the scary part. Edom is put in the blank to fill in the picture. But this is a picture that applies to everyone who displays the spirit of rebellion against God. And so we have another passage in Revelation that talks about that. It says, "Then I saw heaven opened up, and here came a white horse." You're all familiar with this passage. "The one riding it was called Faithful and True. And with justice, he judges and goes to war. His eyes are like a fiery flame, and there are many diadem crowns on his head. He's dressed in clothing dripped with blood." Oh, there's that image again. In Revelation 19. And who is this? We know who this is. "And he's called the Word of God." Who's called the Word of God? This is John writing. "In the beginning was the Word." This is Jesus. "From his mouth extends a sharp sword so that he can strike the nations. He will rule them with an iron rod. And he stomps the winepress of the furious wrath of God." There's the winepress language again. "The all-powerful. He has a name written on his clothing and on his thigh. King of kings and Lord of lords." And there that seals it. That's Jesus, the King of kings, the Lord of lords. I almost want to burst into Handel's Messiah. King of kings, Lord of lords, forever and ever. Right? I mean, all-powerful, his mighty arm. I mean, all these symbols and ideas come up again in Revelation. There's no doubt that John is drawing on images that were put forth all the way back in 700 BC by Isaiah. And it all comes together in our text this morning. So as shocking as this text is, as startling as it is, there's something very glorious about it. And in the end, it accomplishes goodness for the people of God. And it brings about the final thing that needs to happen for the kingdom to be what it is. So it's really a glorious text. Well, next week, I'm going to take a bit of a jump. We've been kind of almost going section by section, but I'm actually going to jump ahead to 65, and it's only 66 chapters, so the end is near for the book of Isaiah and my highlights of it. So just a heads up on that. I've got some discussion questions here, and since we're not in class, I don't know. maybe Sandy and I could have some discussion, but I want to put it out there for those who would like to hear a recording, at least of what was asked. I cannot begin to reproduce the great discussion that we had in class, unfortunately, but I did not manage to record this. So our passage today reminds us of the dreadful fate of the enemies of God. So what do we do with this? Well, these kinds of passages, first of all, should cause us to tremble knowing that we escape such a fate. So the first thing I think that should hit us as we look at a text like this, that should have been us in the winepress. That should have been us whose blood was splattered. And yet it wasn't. Why? Because of what he did in shedding his own blood on our behalf. But that's not true of everyone. But it should cause us to tremble. It should cause us thanksgiving. But I think maybe if we think a little deeper, These passages should cause us to grieve, knowing that such a horrible fate awaits our unbelieving friends and family members. Every one of us has people in our lives, our friends, family members, that we love, that we have relationships with for years, who we trust and we interact with, and on and on and on. And they're headed for this. And we know it. And they seem not to. So I think that's kind of the second wave that should hit you. So I ask this, does reading a passage like this make you want to reach out again to such friends and family members, even though you hopefully have tried many times in the past without success? So I'm assuming here that at one time or another, you at least have brought it up, you've tried to talk to them, maybe you've talked extensively. I'm assuming that. If you haven't, my goodness, do it. But I don't, I thought a long time about this idea, and I'm not one who likes to browbeat in my lessons, and I don't want this to be a browbeating session. I know that for the most part, people that are in your life, they know who you, what you believe. You've had some discussion, and you've tried to press it, maybe to a great degree, maybe not as much in some cases. All I'm saying is, does this make you want to try again? You know, as long as they're alive, there is still hope. I don't care if you've had 100 discussions. Maybe on 101, something could change. Maybe on 101, it makes them go off and talk to somebody else and something changes. There's a lot of ways this can play out. So here's the question I want to ask this morning. I don't want to, you know, have you been talking? Here's my question. By way of encouragement, do you have any stories of someone you reached out to many times without success, but then one day they came around? I have a couple stories I could tell like that, but I'm not going to tell my story. At least I didn't in class. And we had several individuals in class who mentioned, there was one man who mentioned that his father had been an alcoholic, and I think he owned the bar. And he had talked to his father many, many times. And in his 80s, the father had to come live with him. And somewhere in the course of living there, he picked up a book that was lying around, and it had the gospel in it, and God used it to change the man's heart, and he became a Christian in his 80s. So that's a great example. There was another man there who told several stories of people that he talked to. In some cases, they went on and talked to someone else who became a believer, and he found out about it later. The point is that you don't know until they're dead. There's hope. And you want to try to head off the possibility that they would have to face such a terrible thing. Because you know they're headed there, whether they know it or not. And I think at one level they do know it. They know they deserve it. But they're just stubbornly caught in their sinful, rebellious thinking. And by the grace of God, maybe you can get through. So that was one idea. Another discussion. A number of my commentaries were almost apologetic about this passage, fearful that people in our culture might read this and be turned away from believing in the goodness of God. Some expressed concern that people shouldn't read this and think that God is like some raving maniac who takes pleasure in the destruction of the unrighteous. And of course, in one sense, that is obviously true. But I just raised this because the commentators were concerned. They have their finger on the pulse to some degree, at least with some portion of the society. And so I ask, are you tempted to feel that way about this passage? I don't think anyone's going to raise their hand and tell me they are. You're welcome to. But I'd like to raise the question, because maybe you are having that thought, like, my goodness, what kind of a God do we believe in here? Yes?
So, as you were reading all this, my mind was going to a song that I grew up singing. And I think everybody in my generation knew it, but I don't ever hear it anymore, and that is, Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming.
Yes.
Lord, he is trampling out the vintage where the grapes are at the
sword. Yep.
Glory, hallelujah.
Yeah.
You know?
That's right. That's right.
That's the song that goes through my mind. So absolutely not. If God was not the God who dealt with evil in an appropriate way, why would anybody care to be good?
Yeah. And that is, of course, the right way to think about it. But we live in a society that's gone so far off the rails. And I ask, why is it that when people in our day do the kinds of things described in this passage, we rightly view them as evil butchers or serial killers? I could name, you know, Pol Pot or Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler, et cetera, et cetera. And yet God can do these things and still be considered righteous and holy. So here's one of the questions that gets raised. I mean, you know, we think God is good, and yet when everybody else does stuff, it's terrible. Yet somehow God does this great. What's with that? What is the answer to that? Let's just think through this out loud, because there may be those sitting there.
God is perfectly righteous and holy in all that he does. Those guys were not. They were doing it out of selfish ambition and paranoia and other reasons that are evil. And it's all motive of the heart.
Well, that's definitely true. In class today, where this discussion came up, someone brought up the fact that, well, first of all, people in the military or people in the police have to do really bad things to bad people, and they're right in doing it. So there is a sense in which these things even have to be done by people. Of course, the scripture calls them ministers of God, in the sense that a government that's truly doing what God has ordained government to do, which is to punish evildoers, if they're doing that function as they should, then yes, they will end up having to shed blood and do worse kinds of things. I've watched plenty of movies where, you know, the bad guy is horrible and evil, and then some good guys come along and he has to suffer some horrible things for what he did. So that's true. There's another idea that I think we need to consider here, which is, you look at a passage like Romans 12, I believe it is, tells us not to take revenge. Why? Vengeance is mine. So the problem with people who try to do these kinds of things without being authorized, we're setting aside the governmental function, is that they are, in effect, robbing God of his... God has the prerogative to do what he does. And all of us are deserving of all the things that God did in these horrible, gory passages, because we're all sinful, every one of us. So it's not like God never punishes innocent people who are, you know, guiltless. That there is no such person except Jesus, and he took the sins of everybody else. But God has that prerogative, and none of the rest of us have it, unless in those cases where it's granted by God. So there's that idea. So this we need to think through these things. We need to work through these. After you get past the shock factor, you need to be able to walk through it, because there are those who raise objections to these things. There are people in our society who could never believe in the God that does these kinds of things. He's a horrible, evil monster. And they need to understand.
They're the horrible, evil monsters.
And they're going to someday be at the bottom of the grape vat, and it'll be too late for them. So anyhow, good discussion. And somehow it was much shorter to have class with just me and my wife than it was with the class. I think maybe the discussion ran longer. I don't know. But anyhow, I apologize. I feel sad that my recording did not come off, but hopefully this will give you something to listen to, and you can hear essentially the same message that I gave today in class.